This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you're a woman and don't think of yourself as a feminist, Catlin Moran wants to convince you you're wrong. And while she's convincing you, she wants to make you laugh. Her memoir, How to Be a Woman, is a British bestseller and was recently published in the States. She says while her book is about the story of all the time she's gotten being a woman wrong because she was uninformed, underprepared, or fatally deluded, she also wants it to be like an old-fashioned feminist consciousness-raising session, with honest stories about sex, self-image, weddings, marriage, childbirth, abortion, and aging. Not that she's old, she's in her 30s. Moran is a columnist for the Times of London. In 2010, she was named Columnist of the Year by the British Press Awards, and last year she was named Critic and Interviewer of the Year. She started writing for the music weekly Melody Maker when she was 16. Terry spoke with Catlin Moran last Thursday, and parents, some of the conversation went into adult territory.
Catlin Moran, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I must tell you an important fact before we go any further on this radio show.
Yes.
It's that my hair is very big today, and I need all of your listeners to imagine that.
Your hair is very big. Since you brought up your hair has, it's very dark with a gray streak growing across the top. Is that a little shout out to Susan Sontag?
It is. Simultaneously, my two biggest heroes are Susan Sontag and Morticia Adams from the Adams family. And between those two vectors of culture, I lie.
Well, I want to start by asking you to do a short reading from your book. And there are a few things that are quoted from your book by a lot of people, including our book critic. And I've come to think of these as like your greatest hits. So I'm going to ask you to read one of your greatest hits.
Yeah, I think of this one as my Born in the USA, and I'll do it in my posh reading voice.
Okay, great.
So, here is the quick way of working out if you are a feminist. A, do you have a vagina? And B, do you want to be in charge of it? If you said yes to both, then congratulations, you're a feminist. Because we need to reclaim the word feminism. We need to reclaim the word feminism real bad. When statistics come in saying that only 29% of American women would describe themselves as feminist, and only 42% of British women, I used to think, what do you think feminism is, ladies? What part of liberation for women is not for you? Is it the freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man that you marry? The campaign for equal pay? Vogue by Madonna? Jeans? Did all that stuff just get on your nerves? Or were you just drunk at the time of survey? These days, however, I am much calmer, since I realise that it's actually technically impossible for a woman to argue against feminism. Without feminism, you wouldn't be allowed to have a debate on a woman's place in society. You'd be too busy giving birth on the kitchen floor, biting down on a wooden spoon so as not to disturb the men's card game, before going back to hoeing the rutabaga field.
Thank you for reading that. That's Catlin Moran reading from her new book, How to Be a Woman. So why do you think so many women don't want to be associated with the word feminism?
I think it's simply because they don't know what it means. One of the reasons that I wanted to write a whole book about feminism, rather than just endlessly wanging on about it in a bar, which had previously been my technique, it was because I was meeting a lot of younger women, and I would kind of confidently say, oh, well, you know, we're all feminists here. And they would, with a look of horror, as if I'd just banged them on the knee with a fork, go, no, I'm not a feminist. And you go, what do you mean? And, you know, you run through what being a feminist means, sort of like voting and, you know, rape being illegal and not being a legal possession of your husband. And they go, oh, yeah, no, we're into all of that. And it's like, well, you know, you are a feminist then. Women are feminists by default, you know, unless you've actually gone and handed in your vote to Parliament or, you know, to the White House. You are a feminist and you live in a feminist world. The first world is feminist. You are educated equally to boys. You're expected to go into equal employment with boys. In a marriage, you are legally equal. So, you know, you cannot deny we live in a feminist world.
What made you realize that?
I never didn't realize it. I was brought up in a kind of, you know, very hippie liberal family, and it was just always automatically assumed that men and women were equal and indeed superior. I mean, when you've got a mother who's given birth to 8 children, you know, often without any kind of medical intervention, just she gave birth to one of my brothers sort of on the bedroom floor in front of all of us, you see that women are fairly capable. So that was why it was always weird, kind of, you know, whenever we did have a television, our possession of a television was sporadic because we were quite poor and they would often be repossessed. But whenever if we did have a TV and you'd see the women on television, you'd be like, why are these women kind of pretending to be stupid or just kind of just being all blonde and giggly and kind of only operating as an adjunct to the male characters? You know, why aren't the women as important as the men?
So I want you to read another excerpt of How to Be a Woman, and I think of this as another of your greatest hits, another excerpt that has been quoted a lot. And it's basically about your feelings of women thinking that they need to wax their pubic area and have, you know, a clean bikini line. Would you read that for us?
Yes, I like to think of this as my Strawberry Field stroke Penny Lane. It's a double A side, this one. I can't believe that we've got to a point where it's basically costing us money to have a vagina. They're making us pay for maintenance and upkeep of our lulus, like they're a communal garden. It's a stealth tax. Muff exercise. This is money we should be spending on the electricity bill and cheese and berets.
Okay, that's Caitlin Moran from How to Be a Woman. I just want to talk to you, and I should say here, we're going to have an adult conversation. I want to talk with you about how vagina seems to have become the word of the year. Because
yes.
of the way it's entered the political dialogue through the controversy in the U.S. over mandatory transvaginal ultrasounds before an abortion, and then Michigan State Representative Lisa Brown during a debate about a restrictive abortion bill said, "Finally, Mr. Speaker, I'm flattered that you're also interested in my vagina, but no means no." And after that, she was banned from speaking on the House floor. So,
I'd like to think that that was because both she was saying that word and also because she was being funny. And people get really scared when women sort of reclaim words, talk about themselves honestly, and also make jokes, because it's a really unstoppable combination.
So is there anything that's similar to this going on in England now, where the word has entered into the popular vocabulary for political reasons?
No, I mean, we're much more laid back there. It would seem really odd. I mean, I guess we don't have... There's a kind of more sort of Puritan and kind of sort of religious context in America that we just don't have in England. So it's kind of... It's okay to be a bit more kind of loose and rude. But, I mean, when I was watching this this whole kind of controversy unfold in America, I was just thinking that if you just had it so that every woman who was in that room had stood up and said that word in a kind of, I'm Spartacus way, just every single woman in that world had just stood up and, I have a vagina. I have a vagina, like Spartacus. You can't stop that. In the same way that, you know, kind of, there's a, you know, one of the chapters in my book is about abortion. And sort of, you know, when they're talking about restriction of legislation rights in America, if every woman in this country who'd had an abortion just threatened to down tools and not work that day if they brought that legislation in, this country would grind to a halt. And that would be a beautiful and symbolic thing to happen, because women's lives grind to a halt if they are not in control of their fertility, if they can't make a decision about when they're going to become a mother and have responsibility over someone for the rest of their lives.
So let's talk about pregnancy. You write about pregnancy in your book. You had a very difficult childbirth with your first daughter.
Yes.
Just briefly, what are some of the medical problems you had?
I mean, most of it was that I just wasn't ready. I hadn't attended any birth classes. I was insanely unfit. The last sort of 2 months of my pregnancy coincided with Christmas. And it got to that point where I was kind of like eating mince pies and cream for breakfast, thinking that was normal. And then looking in boxes of chocolates and going, well, if I have two with nuts in and two that have got an orange liqueur center, that basically works like kind of protein and fruit. So I'll be smiling. So I put on an enormous amount of weight. And also at that time, I didn't know that I was hypermobile, sort of double jointed, and basically kind of my pelvis sort of cracked in half and stretched in a really bad way, so I couldn't walk. So when I finally went into labor, not only was kind of the two parts of my pelvis grinding against each other, but the baby got stuck. It was the wrong way round. None of the anesthetics worked. The epidurals didn't work. I had five of those. They were fun. And eventually they had to give me an emergency C-section. But I would never have written about a bad birth, because I think women do like to sit around and scare each other with bad birth tales, unless I'd had a really good one for my second birth. And I wanted to contrast it between, if you go into your first birth unprepared, it could go wrong for you. If you prepare for a birth, which I did with the second one, I was fit, I went to all the classes. And the main thing that I learned is that if you are lying down to give birth, gravity is not helping you. You know, you stand up and, you know, a baby will basically kind of fall out of you if you keep walking around. But as soon as they have you, which is the medicalized birth, on your back with your feet in stirrups, you're kind of pushing a baby out sideways. And it really will feel like that. You kind of want to be standing up and having it falling out.
So I'm almost surprised that you were willing to have a second child considering the agony of the first birth, though, you know, what a lot of people say is that women, if women really remembered what birth was like, they wouldn't have more children.
Oh, yeah. You're still addled. Like, for the 2 years after you've had a kid, you are so addled with hormones. You're like, yeah, bring all the babies. I'll have all the babies. That's why after I'd had my second one, I was kind of going, we should have a third one. And my husband was like, let's just buy cats as a holding mechanism. Just kind of give you something else to mother for a while. And sort of, yeah, no, sure enough, once 2.5 years had passed, suddenly all the hormones left. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm okay with two.
Well, not only were you okay with two, you actually got pregnant again after your second child. And you decided to have an abortion. And it was not an anguished decision for you. You write that you knew immediately that you wanted an abortion. You write, not even for a second do I think I should have this baby. This isn't who I'm going to be again. After wanting children so badly, having a very difficult first birth, going ahead with the second, and that was an easy birth. You really wanted to be a mother. You had two children. Why were you so sure that you did not want to have the third child?
I think, well, I mean, as I put in the book, in the same way that I know that I don't want to be blonde or go to India or own a gun, you know, really fundamental sort of, you know, things about who you are. I just knew I didn't want to be a mother again. I think when I see a lot of people talking about sort of like sort of anti-abortionist pro-life dialogue, a lot of it is said by men or people who haven't had children. Because I think if you know what it involves being a mother, that's not something that you can say in a kind of, yeah, hey, I'm sure I'll be able to busk through again a third time. You know, you know, I'm not a gambler. I'm a calculator, I'm a planner. And I knew what the odds were of me being able to do as good a job on having a third child as I had with the last two, to the standards that I wanted to be totally there for them. I just knew I couldn't do it again. And I think it's a really important thing for women to be able to just put their hands up and go, I can't actually do any more. The sort of the template of being a mother is that you're endlessly giving to the point of exhaustion. You know, the stories that you see in those kind of tabloid magazines that you see in supermarkets about kind of, you know, I was told that if I gave birth, I'd die, but here's my miracle baby now. Women who just kind of against all the odds just kind of keep nurturing and nurturing and nurturing until they wear out. You know, that's amazing if you can do that, but for that to be seen as the norm of motherhood, that women are always supposed to give until they're exhausted, you know, to always take on all these burdens, I just think it's a really lovely and beautiful thing, and that's why I'm so, in favour of protecting all of the abortion legislation we've got, to give women the right to go, I can't do that.
So you have a chapter in your book about women who make the decision not to have children, and you want to express your approval to any woman who decides that that is her preference. And, you know, it wasn't always something that women could decide. I mean, they didn't have the birth control to effectively make that decision, even if they wanted to. And society would certainly not have approved of it. You know, any woman not having children would have been seen as, you know, tragic, sad, pathetic.
Well, the word barren tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah.
In the same way that the word spinster tells you everything you need to know about our attitude of women who choose not to marry, yes.
But do you still think that that chapter is needed, that women who decide not to have children need that kind of reassurance and that there will be some kind of societal disapproval of them?
Oh, God, I mean, it totally still needs. I mean, just this week on the cover of Grazia, kind of like the biggest selling women's magazine in the UK, was yet another picture of Jennifer Aniston with, Jennifer's baby fear. We've spent 15 years discussing whether this woman's going to have a baby or not. I just think that's so rude. Is she pregnant? Is she pregnant? Does she want a baby? Is she sad? Did she still wish she could have Brad's baby? Is she going to adopt a baby? Is she going to have a baby with this new boyfriend and then leave him so she can be a single mother? It's just never been an option for Jennifer Aniston not to have a kid. Imagine if you saw George Clooney on the cover of a magazine every week with, is George broody? Is George going to adopt a baby? When's George going to have another kid? It would just seem weird. We'd seem demented. And I wrote that chapter for two reasons. It's a love letter to my sister Kaz, and she's from the age of 10 always known that she doesn't want kids. And it was spurred by the fact that, having worked for women's magazines myself as a journalist, if you'd go off and interview a female celebrity, I'd just go in and interview them like I'd interview any human being and talk about the things that interested me. And you'd come back and you'd file your copy. And then my editor would read through my copy and go, why haven't you asked them if they want kids? And I'd be like, well, I don't know, I interviewed Aerosmith last week and I didn't ask him that. And they'd be like, no, you then she just would ignore that and go, look, just ring the PR and just get her to fix up another sort of quick phone interview, 5 minutes, where you ask her if she's going to have a kid or not. And I'd be like, why? Why would this be the question above all else? I'm genuinely more interested to know if a female celebrity wants to grow her own vegetables in her back garden and become self-sufficient than I am to find out if she does or doesn't want a baby. So it was just to stop this women constantly being asked if they're, you know, a woman gets to 32, and even if you do it in a kind of double back ironic way to say to her, is your body clock ticking? Tick, 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 tick. I mean, it's the only thing that would spur me into violence. It's just a horrible thing to keep saying to a woman, do you want a baby inside you? I mean, it's creepy.
Let's talk about your background a little bit. You grew up in like an industrial town in England.
Yes.
Your father was a drummer in a rock band?
That's right, yes. He was our rock and roll contingent. He faked his passport when he was 15 and ran away from home and did the same. He was in a kind of psychedelic rock band, and they did the same tour circuit as the Beatles, kind of 2 years after the Beatles. But he just sort of never made it. So we were brought up in this kind of... And he never made any money, and he met my mother, who was from sort of quite a nice background. But the presumption always was that he was going to make it as a rock star next year. So kind of when we were watching television and we saw Bob Geldof and his sort of beautiful children, I would always presume that next year I would be friends with Bob Geldof's kids, and those would be the people I would be hanging out with, and we'd all be at Live Aid together backstage. But that continually and persistently never happened for my entire childhood.
No, in fact, you were living on the British equivalent of welfare.
Yes, in the British equivalent of the ghetto. It was pretty rough and it was pretty poor. Sometimes we didn't have enough to eat, and we certainly never had enough clothes. I was brought up in my mother's underwear, and my father's thermal underwear in winter was my pajamas.
And when you often didn't have enough to eat, but you're right, when you did have enough to eat, you binged, and that
yes.
Your siblings, or at least your sisters, binged too, and you ended up becoming very overweight. You got fat.
Oh, the whole family did. I mean, even mm-hmm. now, sometimes just for a laugh, I'll arrange to meet all of my siblings in an all-you-can-eat buffet. even 20 years after we got out of that scenario, there's just all of us will just be hovering there, just like with a tray going. After 3 minutes, you get into that kind of carbohydrate tunnel, and you're like, we could just not bother with the plate. Let's just pile it straight onto the tray. Let's eat the whole tray of food. It was very much wax and wane and binge and fast. We all became very, very fat. And also, we were taught at home, which kind of, my parents were kind of quite apocalyptic. They kind of believed that the end of the world was nigh. And also that they couldn't be bothered to get everybody's school uniforms ready for school. So a combination of those, that very prosaic thing and that complete belief in the end of the world meant that we were taught at home. So all that happened was there were just seven enormously fat, pale, shy, socially awkward children stuck in a very small house all day watching the classical musicals of MGM whilst eating an enormous amount of cheese.
So you were homeschooled without the school part, without the schooling part?
Yes. Yes. And without the home, really. I mean, it wasn't a very homely place. You know, we had no lovely patchwork curtains on the windows. We just had, at one point, my parents decided to breed Alsatian dogs, and got one of the biggest and most violent dogs you can get. And the dogs were not house trained. And at one point, we had 8 children of 14 Alsatians in a 3-bedroom house.
Oh no!
And the smell
really?
And the noise was fairly rank. Yes. So television and films and books were very important to us. We all escaped into books.
And it sounds like you had to do a lot of the parenting of your siblings.
Yes, which I never resented then. I mean, I've always been very, very cheerful. I mean, I genuinely believe that if you've been moaning about something for 3 minutes, you should have started doing something about it 2 minutes ago. And my diaries of the time have all the joyful ebullience of an idiot. It's just sort of stuff like, moved the deep fat fryer onto another sideboard. Looks great. Found a new way to store shoes in a cardboard box under the stairs. Brilliant. So I was enormously cheerful because all the heroines that I read about, this is why books were so important to me, like kind of, you know, Jane Eyre, she's poor and working class and a bit gobby and she triumphs, and Anne of Green Gables, she's kind of an orphan and a bit weird, but she triumphs, and, you know, Katie Carr in What Katie Did, you know, she's disabled, but she triumphs, and Annie in Annie, you know, it was all about kind of like, you know, girls from restricted means making it, which is kind of sort of very much the trope of heroines from like sort of, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century literature. So that was the, you know, the stuff that I clung to.
Do you think being fat contributed at all to
not losing my virginity till I was 17? Yes, definitely. Yes.
I was going to say to your sense, your early understanding of feminism, because the whole kind of feminine thing was something you weren't going to easily fit into.
Yes. I mean, I was brought up in the 80s. I was born in 1975. So by the time I get to 10 and I kind of knew that I probably was going to have to be a grown-up lady at some point, the feminine role models that I had were kind of the cast of Dynasty in Dallas. And I just found that terrifying. I just remember sitting there sadly going, I'm just not going to make it. I'm just literally, it was like being a woman was a boat that was leaving a dock and it was already too far away for me to jump. I mean, how could I, this fat girl in Wolverhampton, you know, just who had no clothes, I didn't have a coat, I was wearing a dressing gown for a coat, a tartan dressing gown, look like Alexis Colby Carrington or beautiful Sybil Shepherd in Moonlighting or, you know, or even Agnes DiPesto in Moonlighting. I just couldn't, you know, I would cling to people like Doris in Fame and it was kind of like, but it's okay, it's just her personality will get her through. I'll have a personality instead. That'll be useful. I just wanted to be normal. It wasn't even being beautiful. I just wanted to be smooth and thin and have beautiful glossy hair and lovely clothes and be able to walk in heels. And I thought that once I did all of that stuff that my life would begin. And I sort of got to remember getting to about 28 and 29 and still really realizing that I subconsciously thought that when I was perfectly smooth and perfectly thin with perfect hair and beautiful outfits and I could sort of spring out of bed and just put on a beautiful kind of beautifully tailored skirt suit and pick up my massive clutch bag and put on my heels and go down and drink half a cup of coffee before going mustache and getting into a cab, that would be the point where my life would begin. And just realizing I was never going to do that even one day ever, let alone that be my life. And I think loads of women have this idea that their life's going to start at some point once they've busted all these problems of being a woman. Once we're thin and we're pretty and we've got all of our clothes and stuff and we're fabulous, that's when our life will begin.
So if fabulous for you wasn't going to be the perfect skirted suit and the expensive clutch handbag and the heels and everything, how did you redefine fabulous for yourself?
Well, I went through several phases, though. When I realised that I wouldn't be fabulous, I just thought I could be so, that I could just be a muse. It still hadn't occurred to me I could actually do anything in my life. I'd given up on being beautiful, but I thought I could be kind of inspiring instead and kind of inspire boys to write songs about me. So I became a music journalist at the age of 16, and I had sort of dyed bright red hair down to my waist and sort of stomping around in my little Doc Martin boots, and I just sort of tried to stand around being fascinating and saying amazing things, often things that rhymed in the hopes that they'd be able to pick them up and just turn them into lyrics straight away. I mean, I was just trying to save them time. You know, I wanted a Layla written about me. I would have had a Rita written about me. I would have become a traffic warden if I'd had to. But that never happened. And it was only, again, the penny didn't drop until too far into my life. And I would just hope that another generation of women aren't as stupid as my generation was. Or I just realised I was going to have to do it myself. If anyone was going to write a song or a book or make a film about a girl like me, it was going to have to be a girl like me, and quite literally, me.
Thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It's been a hoot.
Catlin Moran speaking with Terry Gross. Moran is the author of How to Be a Woman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The various music styles of Eastern Europe's Roma people, formerly known as Gypsies, have become favorites with audiences around the world. Music critic Milo Miles says that no group does a better job of blending tradition with innovation than the ensemble led by Boban Markovic and his son Marco.
A dozen years ago, if someone told me that one of the liveliest, most inventive party albums of the year came from a band originally associated with wedding celebrations and beer festivals, I would have been all, yeah, sure, you bet. If it was further explained that the band's roots were much closer to polka than rock, funk, or hip-hop, I would have responded, don't push it. But nowadays I am familiar with the Boban and Marko Markovic Orchestra, and their retrospective Golden Horns will lighten the heart and lift the feet as surely as anything you'll hear in 2012. I'm just glad they finally released an irresistible introduction. Expanding on long-standing brass band traditions of the Roma people in southern Serbia, Band founder Boban Markovic was a regional powerhouse well before his group was heard in the West. The Orchestar only plays at the major Balkan Brass Band Festival as a guest of honor, so that somebody else can win prizes. But it's hard to deny that the ascendance of Boban's son Marko Markovic is what opened the door to the world for the group. Boban and Marko are equal but different trumpet stylists, Boban more languid, Marko more jabbing. But as the de facto current leader of the Orchestar, Marko gives the newer numbers a worldly juice, a quicker pulse suited to the internet age. Yet as immediately appealing as individual Orchestar tunes can be, there's something elusive about the way they work and exactly how to present a series of performances. This is not a tight band led by virtuoso soloists, instrumental or vocal. The punch comes from the ongoing collective interactions of more than a dozen players, plus guests, with a rollicking feel that most suggests early jazz ensembles, such as Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers. Before Golden Horns, the Markovic Orchestar tended to hit snags with slow numbers that felt too old-fashioned, or vocal features that seemed oddly melodramatic. Although obviously not an issue during free-flowing concerts, finding the right vocals and how to mix them in was a challenge in the studio. The tracks on Golden Horns were selected and programmed by DJ Robert Soko, and his sense of how to get Balkan beats going in your living room is key to the album's appeal. Here Soko picks a vocal tune that's not typical for the Orchestar, but perfect for changing the pace from a dreamy sequence of songs. Finally, I'd like to offer a shout-out to the wonderfully robust passages for tuba on display in Golden Horns, such as in the tune Clock. I played tuba in my high school marching band. How come we didn't do wild stuff like that? Because sly folks like Boban and Marko Markovic weren't calling the shots. That's why.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed the new album Golden Horns. Coming up, supermodels, then and now. We'll talk with the director and two subjects of the new HBO documentary About Face, which explores modeling over the years. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. HBO recently premiered the new documentary About Face, Supermodels Then and Now. featuring models talking about their careers spanning from the 1940s through the 80s. The film focuses on how the idea of beauty has changed and what these models have done to meet those standards. The models also talk about aging and how they've decided whether to have plastic surgery. Some of the models featured in the documentary are Marissa Berenson, Paulina Porizkova, Isabella Rossellini, Christie Brinkley, Jerry Hall, and our next guests, Carol Alt and Beverly Johnson. In 1974, Johnson became the first African-American model to be featured on the cover of American Vogue. As a model in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, she appeared on more than 500 magazine covers, including Glamour, Cosmopolitan, Essence, and Ebony. Carol Alt has also been on hundreds of covers, including two Sports Illustrated swimsuit editions. She's also in the new Woody Allen movie, To Rome with Love, playing Alec Baldwin's wife. Also with us is the director of About Face, Timothy Greenfield Sanders. Fashion isn't his world. He's best known as a photographer whose subjects have included Michelle and Barack Obama, George H.W. and Barbara Bush, George W. and Laura Bush, Sandra Day O'Connor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Toni Morrison, Lou Reed, Muhammad Ali, and porn stars.
Beverly Johnson, Carol Alt, Timothy Greenfield Sanders, welcome to Fresh Air. Timothy, let me start with you. Why did you make About Face? As a photographer, what interests you in that world?
I was interested in aging, really. I saw this as a kind of metaphor for how we grow old and deal with the changes in our lives. And here was this perfect group of people who were so beautiful. You know, it's a hyper look at aging. And I thought that could be interesting.
Carol and Beverly, can I ask you each how old you are? Would that be okay?
Sure.
I don't mind. It's on Facebook and everywhere else.
Yeah, what is it?
Just have to
right?
Google us. Exactly. I was born 1960. I'm going to let you do the math.
I'm 59 years old.
I'm doing the math. Wait, hang on.
51.
Thank you. Okay. Good. So let's start talking about when you started modeling. When you started modeling, did you have to change anything physically about yourself to be considered beautiful enough?
Besides 40 pounds.
40 pounds? No. Seriously, 40?
About 40 pounds, yes.
Well, how much did you weigh when you started?
140.
And you're how tall?
5'9".
How average is that?
Oh, that was, well, you know, for a model, it was...
I don't mean for a model. I mean for a normal human being, a normal human woman.
I don't know. I'm a supermodel. I'm not kind of, well, I mean, I don't know. I think it's kind of tall. I mean, I always felt tall.
But it's average weight, I think. It's about average
weight
for that.
I mean weight, not height. Yeah, okay.
Oh, weight.
Weight.
Oh,
weight.
Oh, yes.
Were you considered chubby, or is it just the fashion world that thought of you as overweight?
Oh, just the fashion world.
Okay, so you had to lose 40 pounds, and Carol, what about you?
I weighed 165, and I was 5'8½", so yes, they wanted me to lose weight. I lost at one point probably around 50 pounds for the cover of Sports Illustrated. I was 115 pounds, but I was also at that point 5'10". I grew until I was 25. They also had an issue with my hair, because, of course, I took a scissor to it, like any normal teen would do when she doesn't like her hair. And so that was the comments, and I mention it in the film. I said, the first thing they said to me is, your hair looks like who pucks your eyebrows, and you're too big for our clothes. And that about summed me up at 17.
So you both had to, what, starve yourselves in order to lose that much weight?
Well, I think it's much easier to do that when you're 17. I mean, I think you bounce back from those kinds of things at 17 a lot more easily than you do at a later age. It was easy for me. I just really stopped eating, you know, could live on basically body fat for a while. And it was really the stupidest thing I ever did. Really, starving yourself is no way to get any kind of self-image. But when you're 17, you don't know any better. And certainly coming from Long Island, where I grew up on pizza and Chinese food and tacos and bagels for breakfast with butter, I had absolutely no clue about nutrition and never really thought I was fat, because I actually was an athlete. I played all the sports at our high school. I just thought I was sportive. Bev?
I was 103 to 117 pounds during my entire career. And as a young woman, it was okay. I was in the business and modeled for, I don't know, at least 3 decades. And the interesting thing was that no one ever said I was too thin. Everyone kept giving me compliments on how great I looked, and I was just emaciated. And I do think, for me, did a lot of damage to my body. I mean, I never get hungry. I have to remind myself to eat because, you know, whatever happens in the brain when you starve yourself like that, the brain doesn't, you know, tell you when you're hungry anymore. And I can imagine what, you know, other, so far so good with the other health issues that one can have from, you know, doing that to your body for so many years.
Beverly, you are the first African-American model to be on the cover of Vogue. And this was in 1974?
Yes, August 1974.
So when you got started in modeling, what was the look that was popular at the time, or what were the looks that were popular at the time? And what was it like for you as an African-American woman to try to fulfill that look when the look was white?
Well, I was just a young lady and had been given an opportunity to model and realized the money that could be made modeling, $75 an hour, was like, you know, more money than I've ever seen in my life. My father made $100 a week. So I basically, the look was the girl next door. I started in the 70s, and I wasn't a part of that amazing era of the 60s with Verushka and Jean Shrimpton and Tweet. Oh, that era was, for me, my favorite. So I was, you know, was ushered into an era of, you know, the girl next door. I didn't really distinguish myself as the black girl next door. I was just the girl next door because that's kind of how I think of myself. I don't really think of myself in color, I guess. But so I was just doing what any model does.
At that time, was it hard or easy to find makeup artists and hairstylists who understood your skin or your hair?
Yeah, that was scary because there were no black makeup artists and there were no black hairstylists. And I was working for Vogue and Glamour, and they were, I mean, it was just really interesting to see a hairdresser just fumbling around with my hair. I think that's why I wore my hair pulled back for a lot of my career, you know, just really slick back, although it was really gorgeous, but because they didn't know how to work with my hair. Not only did they not, and makeup artists and hairdresser at that time didn't know, because they never worked on anyone black before, is that, you know, even the photographers didn't really know how to photograph me. And also Kodak, they didn't even have that range of color, and Timothy, I will have to comment to that, in order to really capture who I was. Or they didn't know how to do the lights to capture who I was or how I looked. So I ended up as black ink spots and just really looking really weird a lot. So it was a big transition. You know, I forgot all about that. What a great question.
Timothy, you know, is it true that like Kodak didn't have the right palette for African-American skin?
It's absolutely true. Uh-huh. It's absolutely true that film was based on Caucasian skin. So unless you opened up a third of a stop for an African-American face, your exposure was wrong. And very few people understood that. And when I did the Blacklist film, I was very conscious
This was portraits and interviews with African-Americans.
Exactly, and 50 African-Americans across America, and Beverly was one of the subjects. One of the highest compliments I got was, you know, how beautiful my portraits looked, because people didn't know, even today, they still have difficulty shooting people of color.
Beverly and Carol, I'm wondering, when did you first started to be concerned about getting older? Like the first time you saw, you know, wrinkles or crow's feet where you thought, it's over for me.
Beverly, you want to go first?
Well, for me, I would say I was 21. And the whole thing is that everyone always, I can remember so distinctly. And it was with Susie Blakely, and, you know, we're in the I was thinking I was doing Sears, and we're in the dressing room, and she says, just wait till the new young model comes along and how scared you're going to be. And I was just, you know, looking at her because she was so gorgeous, and what is she talking about? And sure enough, a few years later, you say, oh, how old are you? I'm 15. I'm like, holy crap, and I'm 21. Every day, that's how you lived your life in the mod for me. In the world of modeling, was that you were just waiting for the phone not to ring. Impending doom, I call it.
21 is so young to be worried about getting old.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Carol, what about you?
I remember the first day, my first shoot with John Stember for Italian Bazaar, and I sat down, and Rex, who was the makeup artist, I sat down in his chair, and the first thing they said that he asked me was, so what are you going to do after modeling? And all I could think of was, I'm 17 years old. This is my first day. I'm like, this is my first day. He's like, it goes fast. You have to think of something you want to do after modeling. So already, you know, I sat down in that chair the first day, and I was already planning, what do I want to do when this is over? How am I going to prolong this? I mean, I did posters and calendars and exercise videos and books and all this stuff simply to keep me in the business because I didn't want it to end. I just loved what I was doing. This is an incredible business. Drugs aside, eating issues aside, all these things aside, it's an amazing business. You meet incredibly creative people. But that first day, immediately it was, uh-oh, I better start thinking about what I want to do when this is over.
In the movie About Face, one of the issues that's discussed is plastic surgery and whether it's, you know, a wonderful thing to have the opportunity to make your face look younger, or whether, as Isabella Rossellini says, it's the modern equivalent of foot binding and it's kind of, you know, misogynistic. I wonder what each of your positions is on that, how you feel about plastic surgery.
I think it's great. I think, you know, everything that we just live in a world where we know we're living longer and we know so much about health and looks. And, I mean, you can even buy a skin cream now that really does diminish wrinkles. I think it's fantastic. People don't understand. With plastic surgery, there's always a trade-off. You just don't, you know, get plastic surgery and you look 20 years old. First of all, you would look scary. But there's scars. There's no such thing as getting plastic surgery and it really makes you look young. It's just... You know, that does not exist. There's always a trade-off in that operation.
It changes your look. It really does.
And it changes your look and all of that. So in moderations, I think it's fantastic. It's absolutely great. You know, if you want to, you know, do, you know, a little nip and tuck here and there, and it makes you feel better and keeps that illusion going for you, why not?
So I agree with that.
Let me
Beverly.
Just, hang on one second. Is it inappropriate for me to ask if you've done that? Is that inappropriate?
No, it's not. And I haven't done it because they've got to really work on getting so that, you know, people of color, you know, tend to keloid. So, you know, we once again, another strike against the black folks. But, you know, so it's not as accessible to us yet. Hopefully they're going to invent something where you don't keloid. But no, and also I come from the lucky gene pool. You know, I've been very blessed in a sense of, you know, how I look right now. So, but I have no problem with doing something if something falls down. Believe me, I'll be the first one in line. As a matter of fact, I'm making sure I have enough money so that I can have that done. So, you know, I'm all for it. I really am.
Okay. Timothy, as a photographer, can you tell by looking at somebody if they've had work done? And does their face move differently if they have? Is it harder for them to be as expressive if they've had any work?
I can absolutely tell. Immediately, you could... The nose is sort of a giveaway because if they've had something done with their nose, you can see that their eyes are kind of looking over what used to be there. And the skin doesn't look right. You can see things in the ears. I mean, and also, more importantly, you say to someone, let me see a little smile or something. They can't really smile. It's not an authentic smile. It's too tight. And Personally, I'm very against it. I remember I was with Fran Lebowitz years ago at my house at a party, and we were talking about this very subject. And my wife Karen and I were saying, oh, we would never do this. We'd never do this. It's terrible, facelift. And Fran whips around and says, well, you're not on the market. And it was an interesting observation. It made me think, you know, okay, I wouldn't do it, but I could understand why people would want to do that. I mean, my values are that if I look old, you know, that's who I am.
From being photographed occasionally myself, I always feel like I'm just not really good at smiling for a camera and that I just go kind of blank and vacant. And it's just really hard for the poor photographers working with me to get, you know, a relaxed smile. So, Timothy, as a photographer, what do you suggest to people who aren't pros at being photographed about how to look relaxed? And Carol, as a pro, what do you think about when you're getting photographed so that your face and your body are as alive as possible?
Timothy, you go first.
90% of the people out there look better on their left side. So turn so that your left side is facing the camera. That's the biggest secret out there. Keep your chin out a little bit. And I think, you know, you have to feel comfortable with yourself. Photographers need to make you feel comfortable. And that's what I do. There's everyone has some moment, some angle that is their best angle. And great photographers can see that instantly.
It's so funny because Timothy asks Isabella Rossellini what side. She goes, well, I like them both. It's very cute. My sister always had a very hard time in front of the camera. I just tell you, think about anything else. Anything else. If you think about your face, what you look like, especially as a woman who's aging because my face is changing, if I think about what I looked like before and what I look like now, it's completely different. I tell them to just relax and just think of anything else. Think of a boyfriend, look across the room at a gorgeous guy, anything else.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Pleasure.
Carol Alt and Beverly Johnson are two of the supermodels featured in the new HBO documentary About Face, Supermodels Then and Now. Timothy Greenfield Sanders directed the film. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.